The committee will come to order. See how they obey me? Representative Szymanski, would you move the February 2 minutes?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes of the February 2 meeting.
Representative Szymanski moves the minutes of February 2nd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. You're welcome to come up and help us out. Today, the Department of Ag and DNR will be giving us the update on bovine TB and chronic wasting diseases. And welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Martin. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And last March, I assumed the responsibilities in addition to my current responsibilities of State Bovine TB Coordinator. Today with me, I have Dr. Paul Anderson from the Board of Animal Health and Dr. Michelle Carstensen from the DNR, who will also be providing some testimony in relation to an update on bovine tuberculosis. I guess I'll just start by perhaps giving just a brief context of where we've been at. I know some of you have heard this before, but I know some haven't. So how much time would you like this conversation to go, Madam Chair?
Whatever you need.
Okay, thank you. Well, I guess I'll just start by saying that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that it's been a very busy year, but it's been a very successful year. And the reason it's been busy and successful is obviously because the legislature took some unprecedented and important action last year via legislation of providing the resources and the authorities for the agencies to carry out a strategy of TB eradication in the area. As a brief history of sort of how we got to this point, just sort of step back in time a little bit of a historical context. Minnesota struggled, and the nation struggled with TB in domestic livestock and in the human population in the early part of the 1900s, and that was primarily due to the human population side. There was issues with unpasteurized milk. We pretty much turned the corner around the mid-70s. In 1976, the state of Minnesota achieved TB-free status, and TB in the country pretty much was under control. We enjoyed that status in Minnesota, and TB was really off the radar screen from the public and from production and agriculture to Minnesota until 2005, when we found a herd in Roseau County. And this herd was found via slaughter surveillance when an animal was sent to a Green Bay slaughter facility. Subsequent to those actions, obviously that was alarming news, and it required additional testing in the area of herds to find out was this an isolated problem or not. Unfortunately, due to that additional testing, we did find additional herds. That fall, we found 4 herds in the area. And then at the same time, whenever we're dealing with a disease like this, we have to be concerned about the wildlife population. So surveillance started with the free-ranging white-tailed deer. And also, unfortunately, we found prevalence of the disease in the deer population. So pretty much what happened, we were trying to deal with the disease between 2005 and 2007, trying to get a handle on what was the magnitude of the problem. In that time frame, we found additional cattle herds, we found additional deer that were infected, and which really what was set this probably on a faster track. That many of you know that there's status downgrades in terms of the USDA. You can only find so many infected herds in a 12-month period before the federal government downgrades TB status, which affects the ability of Minnesota cattle producers to export cattle across state lines. They need to be tested before they're allowed to be sent. And last fall, the fall of 2007, we finally passed the threshold that placed intensive restrictions on the entire state of Minnesota in terms of exporting cattle, which led to this committee and other committees hearing a lot about tuberculosis and the state taking a much more aggressive action in terms of eradicating TB from the cattle herds, and then also much more aggressive actions in terms of limiting the deer populations in the area. Through all this process, there's been some good news, some bad news. Obviously, the good news is that we did discover that the disease is isolated to a small part of the state. But obviously, that it has impacted producers across the state for the last several years. As this is an overview of many of you are aware of what was in the legislation last year that allowed us to take the action we did. But as a highlight, there was a significant source of funds for several activities, mainly the herd buyout, which many of you maybe are aware of, and also the fencing that has gone up in the herds in the area. The appropriation for the herd buyout and the fencing was $3.35 million. I'm happy to say that the herd buyout was very successful. Nearly two-thirds of the animals that were in the area have been removed, and the legislation had a deadline of January 31st, and all of the contracts have been executed, and all of the animals have left the farm. So that part has been successful, and the producers who remain in business, nearly all of the 10-foot exclusionary fencing has been installed. There'll be some additional fencing. It'll most likely be done in the spring, but the high-risk farms, we have the fencing done. The other part, obviously, of funding was providing additional money to the Board of Animal Health to carry out their enforcement activities. In fiscal year 8, the board received $472,000, and in fiscal year 9, $2.172 million. Also, part of that legislation was granting the board the additional authorities they needed to enforce the movement restrictions in the area, and also to direct the Board of Animal Health and the state to pursue split state status. This subsequently has been achieved via the USDA. It was a long process we went through, and that basically freed up the majority of the state, lessened the restrictions and movement of cattle, and then maintained a smaller area in northwest Minnesota where additional restrictions are in place, but allowed us to focus our resources in the area. Outside of that, the other two pieces of legislation last year were providing a property tax credit for the herd owners in the area that remained in business, and then also authorized the Department of Agriculture to initiate a per head tax or cattle assessment that we subsequently started, but we're too early to say how much. We haven't received any dollars in yet, but in subsequent hearings we can definitely talk about that and how that's going. So with that concludes my remarks. If there aren't any questions for me, I'd like Dr. Anderson to provide more of the results in terms of the specifics of the board activities.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Martin? If not, Paul Anderson, would you please come and tell us your story?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm a veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health, and I've been involved with several specific parts of our tuberculosis control program. What I'd like to do is again thank this committee for all the support you've given to the board. We've been very busy and we've had a very successful year, but there's much work yet to do. As Mr. Martin said, we have achieved split state status from USDA, which relieved a lot of the testing burden on our cattle producers from across the state. And what I've been involved with specifically in the modified accredited zone, or the small area of northwest Minnesota that has a modified accredited status, is that for all of these herds in the area, we require that they do an annual whole herd test. What this amounts to is about 325 or 30 producers that have to test their cattle herds every 12 months. And they have to test all their cattle over 12 months of age and any cattle that they add to the herd. Scheduling, as you can imagine, has been a challenge. But our folks, we've been able to hire several people in that corner, and we've actually done about half the testing or a little more than half the testing on those herds with our own staff. We have people that all they do every day is test cattle for tuberculosis. I'm also involved in our staff with movement restrictions, and what we require is that we want to know where all the cattle are in that modified accredited zone in northwest Minnesota as they move from farm to farm. And what we've required these folks to do is fill out a movement certificate, which is much like a health paper. It has all the cattle identification numbers, and they have to actually file that with us and get a permit to move their animals, even if they're just moving within their own herd from pasture to pasture. But at any given time, we should be able to, with pretty good accuracy, tell where the cattle are in that area and where they've been. Now, if something bad happens, if we find another case of tuberculosis, this all helps us to do the epidemiology very quickly and trace the history of that animal. With the cattle herd buyout, that was very successful, and all those herds have been depopulated. Unfortunately, in that process, we did find a 12th infected herd. It's a small beef cattle herd, and it's in the very center where we found deer and we found other cattle herds infected. That herd had had a negative test twice before, and so something happened in the last year or so, and actually there were several animals picked up at slaughter that were infected with tuberculosis. The good news is that the herd's gone. What's concerning for all of us and our friends from the Department of Natural Resources is, where did that herd get infected from? You know, was it in the cattle herd? Did it come from the deer? That's yet to be sorted out. For the herds remaining in the management zone in this small area, we did require fencing to be put up, and the reason for this fencing was to keep deer and cattle apart. Basically, what we're trying to do is keep the deer away from feeding areas and away from where stored feed is kept. And we put up 71,000 linear feet of fence this summer, and actually some of that was put up in the winter when the ground was already frozen. So, but the farmers did very well, and they did get a lot of fence built. Now, this fence is 10 feet tall. It's very sturdy, and it is deer exclusionary, so we don't have any deer that are getting into these high-risk areas where we want to keep them out of. The goal is to keep our cattle population and the deer population apart. If there is tuberculosis on either side of that, we don't want them spreading it back and forth to each other. So we're working very hard to make that happen. Again, I'd like to thank the committee. Madam Chair and committee members, again, thank you for your support. We've accomplished much, but there's much to do yet. We'll be working on this for several years to come, I'm sure. So thank you very much, and that's the end of my report.
Are there any questions? Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we end up with a situation like these, the small herd that was from the buyout, and there is TB present, do we run those animals through the same lab test looking for a DNA footprint and fingerprint and all that stuff to see? I mean, are we testing to that extent to see where that comes from?
Madam Chair and Representative, we do. And where we're at with that process is these animals have been killed just very recently. Tissues were harvested from all of the remaining animals in that herd, and there were several animals that appeared to be clinically infected with tuberculosis. Now, the cultures will take a bit of time to grow, and once the cultures are grown, then that bacteria will be DNA fingerprinted, and we will, you know, look at all those that information, but we're just very early in finding this herd, and we haven't been able to have the laboratories grow up the bacteria yet, but they're in the process. And there'll be a thorough investigation into that to see if it's the same fingerprint.
And, Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. Do we have earlier DNA fingerprints from other infections to compare with?
We do. We have been able to recover tuberculosis bacteria out of many of the infected animals. And the DNA fingerprinting that has been done to date has characterized the tuberculosis that we have in Minnesota, and it's all been very similar. It's very similar to the strains that have been isolated from the southwestern part of the United States, New Mexico, Arizona, those strains. It's very different than what's been isolated in Canada or in Michigan, completely different fingerprints. So, you know, where this came from, we're not sure, but we've not found any different strains yet. And the strains that have been isolated from the deer and the cattle have been the same.
Thank you.
Representative Chemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions on the buyout program, and maybe Mr. Martin or Dr. Anderson can answer this. But once a farmer participates in the buyouts, are they prohibited from repopulating with cattle for a certain length of time?
Madam Chair and committee members, if a person agrees to take the buyout, the way that works is that they agree not to have cattle or any livestock in the modified accredited zone until that area is declared free of tuberculosis. How many years that will be is yet to be determined, but they do agree not to have any livestock of any kind in that zone.
Okay. No, I'm sure.
Representative?
So when you say any livestock, whether it be hogs, chickens, whatever?
That's my understanding.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Anderson, I'll address you a couple, and I might have something from Mr. Martin. The question I have on the 12 herd, which I'm pretty well familiar with, is did you test those calves that were just slaughtered recently, too? I know usually we can't do much with them, but were they actually tested then, too?
Madam Chair and committee, the young calves were all tested. They were all necropsied and tissues were collected. And unfortunately, a fair number of those appear to have tuberculosis. These are calves under a year of age, so that's a little disturbing.
And
another
question. I know they were both these tests. In fact, the one of those two tests that they had negative before was less than a year before it was sold, wasn't it?
Madam Chair and Representative, that is correct.
Now,
Representative Olin.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll address this one to Mr. Martin. Were there deer shot in that area last fall?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe there are, but we have Dr. Carstensen from DNR. Perhaps could give a more specific answer about that.
Dr. Carstensen.
Madam Chair and committee, yes, we have tested deer within a couple miles of that farm since 2005. In fact, I recently looked at just how many deer we sampled in that area, and it was nearly 250 deer. We did find two positives within a couple miles, one in 06 during a hunting season and one in winter of 08 with our sharpshooting operation. So there has been some infected deer in that area, but we've also, as I mentioned, sampled quite a few.
Representative Olin?
Dr. Carstensen, now, last fall during deer hunting season, were the deer that were shot after season two, this last fall after this whole program started, were those all tested too in that area?
Dr. Carst?
At least they were turned in that you know of.
Madam Chairman and committee, from the hunting season, all the animals that are brought to the registration station that we are allowed to sample are tested thoroughly, all the way through culture for bovine tuberculosis. Additionally, any animals removed through our winter removal operations, either through sharpshooting or aerial gunning, are all tested for TB through the whole culture process.
Follow-up question on that. To your knowledge, do any of those show up with tests, or are we making actual progress where we seem to have made good progress?
Madam Chair and representatives, from this past fall, we have sampled approximately 1,250 deer, and we did not see any clinical signs of the disease in those hunter-harvested deer. They are currently at the laboratory in Ames, Iowa, to be cultured, so we don't have final confirmation on those negatives. But it looked, as far as obvious clinical signs, that we didn't have any this year, which I'll be discussing a little bit further also.
But so far, it does look like we're making progress.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was wondering, as far as the source of the bovine TB, going beyond Minnesota, it sounds to me like there were animals that were imported into the state that brought it into the state. Is that, first of all, correct, that there were that that's believed to be the case?
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, there is really no evidence that this particular... There was no evidence. We never found an imported animal that was positive for tuberculosis. You know, with TB, it's one of these chronic diseases that has long incubation periods. It survives at low levels for years and years. It's very difficult to determine, in most cases, how long the bacteria has been in a herd or where it came from. And, you know, there have been people that have theorized that maybe it was imported years and years and years and years ago, but we really never were able to nail that down.
Okay, well, thank you. I was just wondering if, it is difficult to nail down where it came from, and that's never been really an objective, I suppose, since it can be in incubation for so long.
Madam Chair and committee members, the Board of Animal Health did extensive investigation into the animals in these herds, and we went back in records as far as we possibly could. Certainly we were trying to identify if we could find out where it came from, but we were never able to actually definitively do that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Anderson, you said something right toward the end at one answer about the calves that I think it was Representative Olin asked for, and you said it was particularly disturbing because they were less than a year old. And I was wondering, could you elaborate? Just for general information, can you elaborate why is that especially disturbing?
Madam Chair and committee members, the reason that this is disturbing to us is because it indicates that there's active infection. You know, these were not older animals that had been infected years ago. These are young animals that possibly could have been infected from their mothers if the mothers were infected with TB, and they could have been infected in utero. But they could have been exposed by other means as well. But if this happened, it would have happened within the last year. So things are not, this is kind of an acute situation, really, when you find it in young animals. And so we're trying to sort through that, but we're certainly worried about that this disease is still spreading about.
So, Madam Chair, and Dr. Anderson, so thanks. So it's not a fair assumption then to think that the calves contracted TB from the mother. It's a possibility, but not an absolute necessity.
Yeah, the problem with this herd is that the cows are gone, and the cows were tested a year ago, and they were negative for TB. Those cows also went through slaughter, and they were not detected to be infected at slaughter. So now what we have is we have calves that were born on the farm, the mother is gone, and it's pretty tough to blame it on the mother. So it's a possibility, but it's also a possibility that these calves could have been exposed in another method.
Are there any other questions? If not... Dr. Carstensen from the DNR.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. For the record, my name is Dr. Michelle Carstensen, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I'm the Wildlife Health Program Manager. I have a brief PowerPoint for you today just to bring you up to speed on the wildlife side of things. This is also provided to you in a handout. The first slide I have shows the current state of affairs, if you will, for where we have found infected deer to date. We sampled over 4,000 animals in this part of northwest Minnesota from the fall of 2005 through the beginning of 2008. I'll talk about this most recent fall season a little bit later. We found a total of 24 infected deer. They've all been within this, what we call TB core area, that center red circle, and that's about 164 square mile area. One thing that is promising is that each year we've done the surveillance, we haven't seen the prevalence increasing. It's been consistently less than 1%, usually less than 0.5%, and again, restricted, it appears, geographically to this area. So those are two positive things that we've detected. Just how DNR is managing for bovine tuberculosis in deer is really two primary strategies. The first one is to reduce deer densities. One of the main ways to combat wildlife diseases beyond TB, but specifically TB, is to try to reduce the number of deer in the area. But if there is some infection, it's reducing the level of that infectivity and spread. There's a number of ways that DNR can work to reduce these numbers, and one is through special hunts and also extended hunting seasons and special permits, the use of sharpshooters or aerial remover operations, and also allowing landowners to remove additional deer on their properties. A second big component in this fight for on the wildlife side is to try to restrict the recreational feeding of deer or elk that are in this area. It's believed that one of the main mechanisms for spread of this bacteria is through shared feed or where saliva can be exchanged. And we want to minimize this as much as possible to reduce disease spread. And finally, we want to continue our disease monitoring and surveillance. We do this every year through hunter-harvested means, but we also supplement this sampling with landowner permits and winter operations, which I'll talk about in detail in a few minutes. Last winter, we began a pretty extensive removal operation in this core area. We did do some sharpshooting. This was through Wildlife Services, which is a division of the United States Department of Agriculture's APHIS program, the first winter of 2007, and we removed approximately 500 deer that winter through ground sharpshooting. But coming into winter 2008, we supplemented the ground sharpshooting with an aerial gunning operation. In total, we removed about 550 deer with the ground sharpshooting and nearly 400 deer with the aerial gunning operation. And in addition, the landowners in that area removed 125 as well. So this is nearly 1,000 deer removed in a very short time frame, concentrated in this core area where we have the infection. All of these deer, again, were sampled for bovine tuberculosis, and we did find 6 to be positive from this pathogen.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Carstensen. You mentioned about the spread of the disease. Does it have to be like nose-to-nose contact, or can it be spread airborne as well?
Madam Chair and Representatives, it can be spread nose-to-nose. It's also through respiratory secretions, so it could be spread through aerosol means, but I think the most common way between species as far as deer to cattle is not necessarily a nose-to-nose situation. It's probably more through saliva that's left at a feed pile where one might have been consuming feed and left that feed source and another animal has come later. This bacteria can survive on feedstuff for up to 4 months in certain studies on hay and other. So depending on the conditions, it can survive quite some time.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, we did remove a lot of deer in a very short time frame last winter, and we tested again all of these animals for bovine tuberculosis. They also had a secondary goal, which was to try to salvage these carcasses for human consumption so that it was more accepted also in the area that these animals weren't being wasted. So deer that were harvested that were absent of any clinical sign of infection were available to the public, and we gave out about 90% of those carcasses to folks in the area that were interested. We also sampled across age classes, so it wasn't just older deer through all the surveillance that we've been testing. We've been testing these younger age classes, and as Dr. Anderson was talking about, the risks of finding this in younger animals would indicate that there's, you know, infection that's ongoing. It's kind of the same for deer. If we find a lot of younger animals infected, it gives us more concern that there's deer-to-deer transmission or active infection going on in the population. So that leads into our Alive in 05 theory, which is basically looking at the 24 confirmed deer that we've found to date. All of those animals would have been alive in 2005 when we first detected this disease in cattle. So the fact that these are older deer and we haven't found a lot of younger deer infected suggests that deer-to-deer transmission may not have occurred, or it's there at a very low level. So again, finding it in younger animals would, you know, make us think that we have a persistent infection and would be more concerning. So this finding it in older animals is encouraging. Also, as Dr. Anderson and Mr. Martin talked about, trying to manage the deer-cattle interface, you know, is a very important goal. And initially, DNR was responsible for some of the fencing work that happened in summer of 07, but now the fencing program is with the Board of Animal Health. So getting that that barrier put up between stored feed to deer and cattle is very important. One other thing DNR did was try to again encourage more deer to be reduced. So we did that by creating a special deer permit area, which encompassed that core area where all the deer that have been found infected to date. We created this new permit area called 101, and we issued special disease management tags at a reduced cost to the hunters. So for $2.50, any hunter with a valid license could purchase unlimited amount of these tags and remove deer in this permit area. We also had special hunts, an early October season and a late January hunt, to encourage additional deer to be reduced. And it's also important to not just focus on one area, but to consider the fact that deer in the surrounding area can also move into this to this core area. So we want to encourage additional deer removed in permit areas that surround 101. So we changed the designation of these areas by allowing more deer to be removed in all the permit areas that surround 101, including Agassiz National Refuge. So we changed that so that hunters could shoot up to 7 deer a season. And then this past fall, as I mentioned briefly earlier, we tested approximately 1,250 deer within this area in the northwest, and that includes the modified zone and about 300 or so deer outside that zone. We did not find any carcasses that came to our stations that looked like they were clinically infected. And in previous falls, we detected at least 3 to 5 to 7 deer that have come in that look like they have the disease. So this is the first time we didn't see that. As I mentioned also that our official results won't be back yet, but at least this was a very encouraging sign that we weren't looking at clinically infected carcasses. And just finally a summary of how many deer we've sampled to date, including this past fall. We've tested nearly 5,500 deer in northwest Minnesota, and again we've had the total of 24 positives that we've detected. So the next step for DNR is really to stay the course, and so far this 1105 theory is holding. We're just in the middle of an aerial deer survey in the core to look at deer numbers and distribution in this area, and that helps us understand if our tools are working as far as our additional deer removal activities, as well as guides us for another intensive removal operation that's scheduled to begin later this month, with both ground sharpshooting and, again, an aerial operation to remove more deer from the core. We're also going to continue enforcement of our recreational feeding ban and keep pressure on deer through these hunting regulations I mentioned that encourage more harvest. And, again, to continue all of our efforts with the Board of Animal Health, Department of Ag, and USDA. Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Carstensen, there's a lot of focus, as there should be, up in northern Minnesota, but there's a significant threat from Wisconsin as well. Could you talk a little bit about the monitoring down in southeastern part of the state? What I understand is that southern Wisconsin is infected, and there is some potential risk there. So, I don't know, can you comment on that, please?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I believe we're talking about different disease when it comes to Wisconsin. They have chronic wasting disease in their state and their free-ranging wildlife population, but to my knowledge, they don't have any bovine tuberculosis.
Okay, but to that point, Madam Chair.
All right,
to that point, that it does add a risk to our cervidae farmers here in the state of Minnesota, and so you're right, I stand corrected. However, is the DNR working closely to monitor that as well, with working closely with southern Wisconsin to monitor that so that we don't have an incident here that could jeopardize the cervidae farmers that we have in our state?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I believe we will be discussing CWD briefly, and I have a presentation that will talk about the surveillance we've done, but just to answer it, in short, we do surveillance in wild deer in the southeastern part of the state, and we have, since 2002, done some surveillance, but we haven't yet to detect it in wildlife.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll keep these questions brief so we get back. You can get to your other presentation, but I don't know who can address this one. Well, you can probably address the first one, Dr. Carstensen. Approximately how long is it going to take to get those tests back from the fall, from the actual lab? Do you know how much, what timeline you'd be looking at there?
Madam Chair and Representatives, I believe they're quite a bit behind schedule because of the bovine tuberculosis outbreaks in California. There was a lot of testing that had to go through the one laboratory that does this in Ames, Iowa. We did have some samples that we submitted that we flagged as kind of suspect or concerning just because the lymph nodes were either enlarged or they had an abscess that we questioned. Those are set to come off culture this week. Preliminarily, they were ruled as parasite migrations and not consistent with bovine TB, but official results will make us feel much better on that case. But as far as the majority of samples, I believe we're looking into later in the spring at the earliest until we find out anything officially.
This is a follow-up of sorts to that one, but not exactly. And Mr. Martin may have to pipe in. I'm not sure which one can answer this. When approximately will the sharpshooting or aerial shooting start? And the reason I ask that is I keep getting calls, and I realize this is not something I'm as concerned about, but I keep getting calls from the deer hunters saying, well, the problem's done, so why are we shooting? Well, we've done all the shooting we need to do in that area. Why are we doing any more? And that's, I was hoping that some results would be finalized before then so we could give those a affirmative action answer as to why we had to do it. Dr. Anderson's answer probably will suffice since those calves had problems, and it may well be from deer for all we know.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'll take a shot at that one. Our current schedule is to begin sharpshooting the week of February 23rd, and we're planning to do a 2-3 ground sharpshooting effort prior to the start of the aerial operation, which is currently slated for the 16th of March, and will run approximately 2 weeks. After that time, we might bring sharpshooting on the ground back to mop up, if you will, but we'll have to wait and see how we progress. On the question about the deer hunters' concern and, you know, if we're done just because of this fall's results look promising so far, I'd add to that this past fall we did collect 1,250 samples, but if we're looking for the amount of samples just from the core, it was less than 100. So I don't think we really have a lot of confidence that there might not be any infected deer there. And this targeted removal operation coming up will really be focused in that area. So I think that'll be another layer of comfort if we don't find any infected deer through this effort. But I think it's way too early to think we're out of the woods completely on the deer side of things.
Madam Chair, if I could add to that, an interagency discussion, we believe that we need to continue to be aggressive in reducing deer populations until the area achieves TB-free status, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to reduce those efforts until the classification is achieved.
Representative Olin.
Just a follow-up comment. Nobody even has to answer this one. I'm agreeing with you having to do this. I'm not disagreeing, but you may need to do a little PR work on right before you start these next series of hunting episodes with some of the deer hunters up there, because I know there are some rather riled.
Any other questions? I guess you can continue with the chronic wasting disease PowerPoint.
Madam Chair, Representatives, thank you. I'm going to begin this discussion on chronic wasting disease with a brief PowerPoint. Again, you were provided this in a handout. I'm going to do a few slides of just a review as to what the disease is. CWD is a fully progressive disease, involves the brain, a neurological disease, and it's in deer, elk, and moose. It belongs to a family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or prions diseases, and they're not caused by a conventional agent like bacteria or viruses. It's actually a misshapen protein called a prion that is the source of this infectivity. As I mentioned, it's a neurological disease, so with that, the signs of this disease are dementia, incoordination, salivating, usually loss of fear to humans where they're able to be approached, where normally that would never occur. There is no treatment for this disease, and it is always fatal. There's also no immune response from the host, which makes it very difficult to ever come up with a vaccine or a diagnostic test that can be used in live animals. There's currently a few techniques that are being used with tonsils, biopsies, and rectal biopsies that look promising, but the most gold standard tests involve post-mortem tissue collection. As I said, it's an unconventional agent, and it's very difficult to inactivate the infectivity of this agent. And it is spread animal to animal, and it can persist in the environment, which adds another layer of a challenge to this disease, because it can survive in the environment for many years. We have been doing a lot of research in the field of CWD nationwide, and we've learned a lot of things in recent years. We know there's accumulation of the protein in the gut and the lymph nodes and lymph system, as well as the brain. We also know that it's an average of 6 months from the time of exposure till clinical signs of disease develop, but it can be much longer. It can be 3 years or longer. So it's a very long incubation time. The distribution of infectivity is limited typically in the body, but a recent study did demonstrate that prions can be found in muscle tissue. And there's ongoing concern of whether or not there's a human health risk to consumption of meat from infected animals, but there's been no conclusive evidence yet to indicate that there is a risk to humans. This specific disease is only known to be in white-tailed deer, mule deer, and elk, but most recently also discovered in moose. And as I mentioned, no transmission evidence to other mammals, and that would include humans. This map is the current distribution of chronic wasting disease in North America. The provinces and states that are shaded in the gray indicate they've had captive infections in captive cervid operations, and then the red colors indicate wild populations. In Minnesota, the number is actually a little outdated. It should be four. And Michigan had a recent case in a captive operation, too, so it's a little bit behind, but it's pretty much an accurate overall look at where we have wildlife infections and which states have been affected with captive animals. To date, Minnesota's response has really been both surveillance and prevention. One is to monitor, of course, our white-tailed deer herd for presence of CWD, and then secondly, to prevent it from entering the state's wild deer herd. And we have a number of efforts that we have done to accomplish these goals, namely collaboration with other agencies is very important, and our stakeholders. We've done targeted surveillance, and that means sampling deer that exhibit signs of disease that could be consistent with chronic wasting disease. We've done that since 2002. We also completed a statewide surveillance for the disease from 2002 to 2004, which tested nearly 30,000 animals. We do some contingency planning, responding for what we would do if we found CWD. We also have import restrictions for cervids from other states where they have endemic CWD infections. In 2002, we had our first case of CWD in Minnesota, and it involved a captive elk herd. Dr. Anderson can talk about this a little bit more detail later, but I just wanted to bring up when we first detected our first case in a captive situation, and then we followed up with a second elk in Stearns County, and that led into the beginning of our statewide surveillance, which we began in 2002. And from 2002 to 2004, we sampled 27,500 deer approximately throughout the state, and we did not find any white-tailed deer that's wildlife deer infected with CWD through that sampling effort. Since that time, we had an additional case of an infected deer in a captive situation in 2006. This was found in Lacapar County. This was a captive doe, and we responded by sampling that fall about 400 or so deer around that farm area and did not find any signs of infection. We also sampled additionally in other parts of the state indicated in this map that was consistent with some areas we were testing for statewide bovine TV surveillance. And in total, we tested about 1,260 deer in all six, and we did not find any positive for chronic wasting disease. And then most recently, we just finished a fall sampling surveillance for bovine tuberculosis, as I was discussing previously, but at the same time, we collected samples for chronic wasting disease through that effort. So while we were in the Northwest testing for bovine TB, we tested approximately 1,000 deer for CWD. We also tested deer for CWD along the Minnesota-Wisconsin border, and that included about 450 deer. We did not find any deer at this time positive for CWD, but not all the samples have been processed yet, and final results will probably be available next month. So where do we go from here? We are finished sampling hunter harvested deer on a statewide basis at this time. We want to continue our work with targeted surveillance. Any sick deer that are reported to us from the public or wildlife officials that we can obtain are always tested for chronic wasting disease. And our sampling efforts, you know, they will increase if any of our risk factors change. A risk factor that would include a CWD found in a captive service facility. And we've now had 4 known introductions of chronic wasting disease into captive facilities in Minnesota. We've had the most recent case just announced a couple weeks ago in Olmsted County. Another risk factor would be CWD and wild microbial populations in our bordering states. Wisconsin has CWD, and that is in, well, it also would be in our southeastern part of the state, would be at most risk to where they have the infection in the wildlife. And then South Dakota also has CWD, but that's in their western part of the state. At this point, they haven't found anything that encroaches our western border. But we continue to monitor our states, our border states, to look for any other threats that might indicate we need to do additional surveillance. And import restrictions will also continue. This map just shows the areas where we have import restrictions in place, where products from like whole carcasses can't be brought into Minnesota. If game is killed in these states, they have to bring butcher wrapped meat and cleaned, professionally cleaned and taxidermy mounts back. So that again minimizes that risk of those types of infectious materials part of the animals brought into our state. With that, I'll take any questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is a curiosity question now. Is there any federal program similar to the TV program existing on chronic waste?
Dr. Carstensen.
Madam Chair and Representatives, there is a program in the federal government. We do receive some funding to do CWD surveillance, and most since our state is ranked as a state that has had infection in captive situations, we typically qualify for $75,000 in a fiscal year to do CWD surveillance. And I do believe they provide assistance on the captive service industry side, which Dr. Edison might be able to comment on.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. They don't have a zone situation, et cetera, verbatim in the federal rules, do they? Or do they have one hidden somewhere? You really have a lot of cases.
Madam Chair and Representative Olin, at this time there is not a state classification system for chronic wasting disease. What most states do, though, is we determine where endemic areas are, where the disease exists in the wild, and we're very picky about importing animals out of those areas.
Representative Olin?
One last question. But it's pretty well left up to state to state. It's not the federal government pinpointing areas so much.
Madam Chair and Representative, there is a chronic wasting disease law that has been pending for about 3 years, and it does not establish state statuses, but it does determine how herd certification programs are to be run, and that still is slated to become law, but has not yet.
Representative Hamilton.
Thanks, Madam Chair and Dr. Carstensen. I came in late, so I jumped one disease ahead, so thank you for correcting me on that. When we're talking about the captives or the cervidae farmers that we have in the state, can you quickly walk us through what they need to go through as far as testing and monitoring when it comes to imports and exports of live animals, and then also what takes place in the event a positive is found on a farm?
Madam Chair and committee members, maybe I can field that one. Let me just talk a little bit about our cervid farm industry is very viable and very active. We have about 650 producers that raise deer or elk in Minnesota right now, and our current inventory for the state is about 18,000 deer or elk of different species. We have a very active reindeer group as well, so lots of folks involved. What they have to do now, legislation was passed in the 03 session that set the requirements for farm cervidae producers. What they have to do is they have to register with the Board of Animal Health. They have to file a complete inventory with us every year with all of their animal ID numbers and their animals. Every last animal has to be identified. they're required to, and how this fits into the chronic wasting disease thing, is they're required to test any animal over 16 months of age that dies or is slaughtered at any time during the year on their farm. And our producers are doing just that. We test about 3,000 samples a year on farmed animals. And as Dr. Carstensen said, we had a case in 02, which involved Aiken and Stearns County. We had a case in 06, which was on a farm in Lac La Parle County. And most recently, we've identified a positive animal on a farm just north of Rochester in Olmsted County. And I'll talk a little bit more about that particular case. Our farmers are also required to have 8-foot fences around their animals. They're probably the most highly regulated livestock people on earth. But they cooperate. They're very good about that. And we have a great bunch of folks that raise these animals in Minnesota.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor. That was the point that I was hoping to get to. There's a battle that takes place up here in St. Paul when it comes with the cervidae farmers and you know the hunters and stuff like that. And the comment that you made about the most highly regulated industry, if you will, or entity, at least in agriculture that we have. I'm hoping that I can stress that to other members up here in St. Paul as well, because it is a very valued industry to our economy, and so I hope we don't make any knee-jerk reactions. And so thank you for the monitoring. Thank you for the work that you do. I appreciate that.
Are there any other questions? If not...
Madam Chair and Committee, may I speak to this case that we found?
That'd be great.
I'd like to just give you a few details about this particular incident. This was a fairly large elk farm near Rochester, and the producers that own this farm contacted our office, and that property has been bought by an investment company that's doing they're building a biomedical research community, and so they're downsizing this elk herd, and they actually had 179 animals that they took to slaughter at one of our slaughter plants in Dawson, Minnesota, which is in Lac La Parle County. And they contacted us for help, and we actually did put a team together, and we collected all those samples with our staff. So I guess if there's good news about it, we know we got the right sample. But unfortunately, we did find a positive. This animal was a cow that was born in 2001, so she was about 7 years old. What we know about the epidemiology of chronic wasting disease is that incubation periods in elk typically are about 24 to 36 months, but we would expect an animal to become clinically ill by then. This was not an ill animal. This was an animal that appeared to be in good health. So the science would tell us that this animal probably became infected sometime within the last 3 years. Now, there's no evidence that there's chronic wasting disease in our white-tailed deer population in that area. So we're looking, and we're just starting our investigation. We're very early on. But we're looking at the herd records, and there's no record of any animals being purchased into that herd in the last 7 or 8 years, and there were no sales out of that herd except the slaughter. They also tested a lot of animals. They've tested about 380 animals in the last 5 years out of that herd. So we're just starting to unravel the puzzle of, you know, where this might have started. And it's much like tuberculosis. The when and how long it's been there is sometimes very difficult to determine. Has this been at a very low level in this herd for a very long time? It's possible. This herd was established in the early 90s. And we know that the original animals that started this herd, did some of them come out of Colorado. We didn't know a whole lot about chronic wasting disease in those years. So we're just starting to unravel the puzzle, but if things go the way that they historically have gone, the animals in this herd will be euthanized. We will test all of them, of course, and then we'll have to take measures to protect the land would be considered contaminated, and so we want to make sure that we do everything we can to keep our white-tailed deer off of that property for several years to come. So we've got a lot of things to put together, and we've been working with our counterparts at Department of Natural Resources and at the Department of Agriculture and the United States Department of Agriculture, of course, and hopefully we can find indemnity money from the United States Department of Agriculture folks and buy this herd and euthanize the animals. But we're early on, and we're just starting to put the pieces together. It's a very sad situation for the people who own this farm, but that's historically been the way it goes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, do you ever have false positives when you do tests? Could it be possible that it was a false positive?
Madam Chair and committee members, with testing for chronic wasting disease, the test that we use is actually a sample of the brainstem, and we also sample lymph nodes. And what they do is they actually stain and identify the actual protein. And so there's no such thing on this one as a false positive. When we find it, we've got it.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you very much. It was very informational, and we're adjourned.